Okay, our first reading today is from the book of Numbers, from Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13, it's on page 201 if you're using one of these maroon Bibles. We're going to be reading first of all Numbers 13, 1 to 3, and then we're going to move on from verse 17 to the end of the chapter. Numbers chapter 13 at verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe send one of its leaders." So at the Lord's command, Moses sent them out from the desert of Paran. All of them were leaders of the Israelites. And then we go on to list the names, but I'm going to skip that bit, just not because it's not important, but because we have quite a long reading. So we're going to move on then to verse 17. When Moses sent them to explore Canaan, he said, "Go up through the Negev and on into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live there are strong or weak, few or many. What kind of land do they live in? Is it good or bad? What kind of towns do they live in? Are they unwalled or fortified? How is the soil? Is it fertile or poor? Are there trees on it or not? Do your best to bring back some of the fruit of the land." It was the season for the first ripe grapes. So they went up and explored the land from the desert of Zin as far as Rehob towards Liba Hamath. They went up through the Negev and came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Sheshai and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, lived. Hebron had been built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. When they reached the valley of Eshcol, they cut off a branch bearing a single cluster of grapes. Two of them carried it on a pole between them, along with some pomegranates and figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster of grapes the Israelites cut off there. At the end of the 40 days, they returned from exploring the land. They came back to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and to the whole assembly and showed them the fruit of the land. They gave Moses this account: "We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan." Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "Who should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are." And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak, come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." Ending our reading there at the end of the chapter, but we'll be doing a little bit more before we the passage. So we're okay, we're going to read again from God's Word, again in the book of Numbers. So just back where we finished off, we're going to read a good part of Numbers chapter 14. Sorry, I'm struggling a bit with the light here, so I have to get into some. I don't think there's anything we can do about it. But, okay, we're starting at Numbers 14, verse 1, following on from where we read. "That night, all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, 'If only we had died in Egypt or in this desert. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?' And they said to each other, 'We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt.' Then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, 'The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord. And do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them.' But the whole assembly talked about stoning them. Then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. The Lord said to Moses, "How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me, in spite of all the miraculous signs that I have performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they." Moses said to the Lord, "Then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power you brought these people up from among them, and they will tell the inhabitants of this land about it. They have already heard that you, O Lord, are with these people, and that you, O Lord, have been seen face to face, and that your cloud stays over them, and that you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. If you put these people to death all at one time, the nations who have heard this report about you will say, 'The Lord was not able to bring these people into the land he promised them on oath, so we slaughtered them in the desert.' Now may the Lord's strength be displayed just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger, abounding in love and forgiving sin and rebellion, yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sin of these people just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now." The Lord replied, "I have forgiven them as you asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live, and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. But because my servant Caleb has a different spirit and follows me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land he went to, and his descendants will inherit it. Since the Amalekites and the Canaanites are living in the valleys, turn back tomorrow and set out towards the desert along the route to the Red Sea." The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "How long will this wicked community grumble against me? I have heard the complaints of these grumbling Israelites. So tell them, 'As surely as I live, declares the Lord, I will do to you the very things I heard you say. In this desert your bodies will fall, every one of you 20 years old or more, who was counted in the census and who has grumbled against me. Not one of you will enter the land I swore with uplifted hand to make your home, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun. As for your children that you said would be taken as plunder, I will bring them in to enjoy the land you have rejected. But you, your bodies will fall in this desert. Your children will be shepherds here for 40 years, suffering for your unfaithfulness until the last of your bodies lies in the desert. For 40 years, 1 year for each of the 40 days you explored the land, you will suffer for your sins and know what it is like to have me against you. I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will surely do these things to this whole wicked community which is banded together against me. They will meet their end in this desert. Here they will die." So the men Moses had sent to explore the land, who returned and made the whole community grumble against him by spreading a bad report about it. These men responsible for spreading the bad report about the land were struck down and died of a plague before the Lord. Of the men who went to explore the land, only Joshua son of Nun and Caleb son of Jephunneh survived. Amen. You know, I'm sure, what an epitaph is, a short phrase or sentence that sums up a person's life and is sometimes put on their gravestone. I wonder, have you given any thought to what you would like your epitaph to be? Perhaps that's a rather shocking thought and something you maybe don't want to think about. How would people remember us when we're gone? What phrase might people use to sum up our lives? Sometimes people have got amusing epitaphs put on their tombstones, perhaps in an attempt to downplay the seriousness and, as they say, the finality of death. Spike Milligan, the comedian and writer who was half Irish, arranged to have his gravestone to have the words in Irish on his gravestone, which rendered in English are, "I told you I was ill." It's reported that there's a tombstone in the west of Scotland which marks the grave of a man called Jimmy Wyatt. Now Jimmy obviously wasn't a very generous individual, because his gravestone reads, "Interred beneath this kirkyard stain," or churchyard stone, "lies stingy Jimmy Wyatt. He died one morning just at 10 and saved a dinner by it." Okay, today we're going to look at an Old Testament character, Caleb, who we read about in those passages from Numbers. And Caleb's epitaph, I think, wouldn't be too hard to write. In fact, there are probably two which come readily to mind. And I think that any of us would probably be quite happy if either of those were our epitaph. But more of that later. We encounter Caleb in the passages that we read in Numbers 13 and 14. And if you have those open, we'll maybe be referring to verses in them as we go along. Caleb was one of the 12 spies appointed by Moses. He represented the tribe of Judah in the group of 12 spies that were sent to spy out the land of Canaan. But before we go into that, we maybe should remind you just of a little of the background, which you probably know, but it's no harm to remind us all. You'll remember how God made great promises to the man Abraham. Abraham was the forefather of the people of Israel. And among those promises was the promise of a land that he would give them, the land of Israel, that he would give to Abraham's descendants as an inheritance. And he told Abraham that his descendants would spend a long time in a foreign land where they would be afflicted for 400 years, but that after that God would bring them out with great possessions. You can read about that in Genesis 15 if you want to look back to that later. And of course God kept that promise, and that did happen. The people of Israel did spend many years in Egypt, and in the latter part of that time they became the slaves of the Egyptians, and they were treated very harshly. But during that time God reiterated this promise of giving his people a land, and he did it particularly at the time when he called Moses to be the leader, to lead his people out of Egypt and out of slavery. And at that time God described the land that he was going to give as a good and a broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And from these descriptions we can take it that this was to indicate that it was a very pleasant land and a very productive land that they were going to inherit. And God kept that promise. He did rescue the whole nation from slavery in Egypt, doing many wonderful things in the process. And now at the start of Numbers 13, we read that they've reached the border of the promised land. They're a place called Kadesh on the border with the promised land. And God tells Moses to appoint 12 spies, one from each of the 12 tribes, to go and to spy out the land to see what it's like. And they're to report back to the people on what they find. They're to report on what the people are like. Are there few or are there many? Are they strong or are they weak? What the cities are like. Are they strong or are they weak? Are they well fortified? What the land is like. Is it good land or is it bad land? If there are trees there. And so on, and they're to bring back some of the fruit of the land. And so the spies go out, and for 40 days they travel up and down the land that God had promised to the people of Israel. And they return, bringing with them a cluster of grapes, a cluster large enough that it had to be carried on a pole between the two of them. And they bring back some pomegranates and some figs as well. And after the 40 days are up, they appear before Moses and Aaron and the rest of the people, and they bring their reports. Now sometimes today, even in church bodies and in other organisations, if there's a particular issue to be investigated, a committee is set up to investigate the issue and bring back the report. And ideally they will all agree and they'll bring back a unanimous report. But if they don't agree, then there's what's called a majority report, where most of the committee agree on the findings and they bring back a majority report to them. There's maybe one or two others that disagree and they bring back a minority report. And this is what has happened here. 10 of the spies bring their report, and they say the land does flow with milk and honey, and here's some of its fruit. But, and in their minds it's a very big but, the people are very strong, they live in very fortified cities, and we even saw giants there, the sons of Anak. And there are Amorites, Jebusites, Amalekites, Hittites and Canaanites all living there. And when we looked at these people, we felt like grasshoppers compared to them, and that's what they thought when they looked at us. So we aren't able to go up and to take this land because the people are stronger than we are. So that was the majority report of 10 of the spies. And this obviously disturbs the people, because we read that Caleb in verse 30 of that first chapter, chapter 13, he has to quieten the people before he can speak. And then he says, and this is him bringing, if you like, the minority report, the report of him, Caleb, and of Joshua. And he says, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." How did the people respond to these two reports? Well, at the beginning of chapter 14, we see how they responded. They accept the bad report. And what effect does it have? Well, it makes them cry and weep through the night. It makes them grumble against Moses and Aaron, and they say it would have been better to die in Egypt or in the wilderness than to die in this promised land. And they grumble against God for bringing them out of Egypt into a land where they'd be killed and where their wives and their little ones would become prey in the land of Canaan. And they even talk about choosing a leader to take them back to Egypt. At this point, Moses and Aaron fall on their faces before the people, presumably in prayer to God. And Joshua and Caleb tear their clothes and say to the congregation, "The land we pass through is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." Surely you might think the congregation would be moved by this impassioned plea, but not at all. In fact, they want to stone Caleb and Joshua, and they probably would have if the glory of the Lord hadn't appeared before them at that point. And God speaks to Moses, and he says to Moses that because of their unbelief and ingratitude, he would strike down the people with pestilence, and he would disinherit them and make a great nation out of Moses and his descendants instead. But Moses at this point intercedes for the people, as he had done a number of occasions before, and he pleads with God not to wipe the people out, but to pardon them. And God, in answer to Moses' intercession, does agree not to wipe the people out, but because of their unbelief and their ingratitude, he says that nobody aged 20 or over would enter the promised land, but they would all die in the wilderness, all except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. And then God speaks about Caleb and says these words specifically, "But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land in which we went, into which he went, and his descendants shall possess it." And it's these words we want to think about particularly. My servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully. We want to think about this different spirit that Caleb had, which set him apart from the crowd. And we want to look at five things which characterize this spirit and which made him different from all the rest, apart from Joshua. Could this be Caleb's epitaph? The man with the different spirit. First of all, then, we see that Caleb's spirit was characterized by it was a spirit of faith, not a spirit of fear and unbelief. All the 12 spies saw the same land, they saw the same people, they saw the same cities, and yet they came to very different conclusions. Two of them said, "If the Lord delights in us, he'll bring us into this land and give it to us." The other said, "We're not able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than we are." How come the different response? Well, the difference is that Caleb and Joshua saw things with the eyes of faith, while the others didn't. They saw things with the eyes of faith. What do we mean by that? Do we mean just that Caleb and Joshua were optimists, while the others were pessimists? Were Caleb and Joshua just seeing things, seeing the glass half full, as opposed to seeing the glass half empty, as we often say? Well, no. When we say they saw things with the eyes of faith, what we mean is that they believed what God had previously said about the land. God had promised that he would give the land to the children of Israel. Caleb and Joshua believed what God had said. They believed that promise. And because they believed God's promise, they believed that God would enable them to overcome any obstacles in their way, whether it was those fortified cities or those giants. The other spies obviously didn't believe God could deliver on this promise. They saw the giants and the fortified cities and they thought, "There's no way that we can do this." Caleb and Joshua saw those things and they believed that those things wouldn't be a problem to God fulfilling his promise. So they had a spirit of faith. Now, it wasn't what we might call a blind faith. It wasn't a leap in the dark. It wasn't that at all. It was a faith that was based on solid evidence. The evidence of God having made promises in the past and those all having been fulfilled. He had promised to bring them out of Egypt and he had done that. In the process, he had seen numerous examples of God at work on behalf of his people. He had sent 10 supernatural plagues on the land of Egypt and on the people of Egypt to persuade the leader of Egypt, Pharaoh, to let the Israelites go. Water, you remember, was turned into blood. There were infestations of frogs, of gnats, flies, and locusts. Their livestock died. The people came out in boils. There was hail destroying their crops. There was darkness. And finally, there was the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians. So God had done, had shown his power through these supernatural plagues, and he'd shown his sovereignty by some of those plagues didn't affect, while they affected the whole land, they maybe didn't affect the peace part where the Israelites lived. And some of the hail, for instance, affected all of Egypt but not Goshen, where the children of Israel lived. And the livestock of the Egyptians died, but the same sort of livestock kept by the Israelites didn't live. So God was showing that he was sovereign. He was able to differentiate between the Egyptians and his own people. So God had given them many evidences of his power. He had rescued them from the pursuing Egyptians, opening up the Red Sea so that they could escape from the Egyptians who were following after them. God had miraculously provided for them in the wilderness, provided water, and provided food to keep them alive. So Caleb and Joshua's faith was based on plenty of evidence. It wasn't a blind faith. The rest of the spies and the mass of the people had a spirit of unbelief. They looked at the obstacles and the difficulties, and their unbelief caused them to think that God couldn't deliver on his promises. You see, their God, the God of their imagination, was too small. Too small for these large challenges, whereas Caleb and Joshua believed in a big God, a God for whom no obstacle was too difficult to overcome. The challenge then comes to us today. What kind of a God do you believe in? Is your God the God portrayed in the Bible, for whom nothing is too difficult, for whom nothing is impossible? Or do you believe in a God of your own imagination, just a God who is just a little bit bigger and a little bit stronger than you are, a God who is manageable, a God who doesn't demand too much of you? Caleb and Joshua had faith. I found this little thing about faith. I thought it was quite good. You can tell me later if you think so. There are seven things that faith does. It believes the incredible. It sees the invisible. It attempts the impossible. It overcomes the overwhelming. It surmounts the insurmountable. Then it faces the formidable. It accomplishes the unthinkable. This was the kind of faith that Caleb had, which enabled him to enthusiastically advocate going in and taking possession of the land. The others, they lacked that kind of faith, and their unbelief made them afraid. Just as we've listed some things that faith does, the passage tells us some things that unbelief does. Unbelief exaggerates the obstacles. Were the giants really as big as they were making out? Well, maybe they were. But in verse 32, they say that all the people were of very great size. I doubt very much whether that was the case. I suspect they were exaggerating because they didn't want to obey God. Unbelief forgets past blessings. Surely if God could defeat a whole Egyptian army, a few Canaanites wouldn't cause him any problems. And unbelief is irrational. Sometimes atheists accuse Christians of believing in fairy stories and legends, but the response of the people and some of the things they say are really just don't make sense. Why would it be better to die in the wilderness than to die in the promised land? Why would it be better to go back to Egypt, that wonderful place where they were slaves for so long? It just doesn't make sense. The spy mission lasted 40 days. In the Bible, 40 days is often associated with testing of some kind. If you think of Jesus was 40 days in the wilderness being tempted of Satan. So the spy mission was really a test. It was a test of the faith of those who went, and it was a test of those who heard their reports. Caleb and Joshua passed that test. The others all failed. Perhaps as you look forward to your life, the rest of your life, you can see some large obstacles ahead, things about which you are tempted to be afraid. Caleb's example encourages us to take heart. God is a big God. No obstacle in your life is too difficult for him to help you to overcome. So let us be encouraged by Caleb's faith. So that's the first thing. That's probably the longest one of the five things. Secondly, Caleb had a spirit of obedience, not a spirit of rebellion. In verse 9 of chapter 14, Caleb and Joshua plead with the people not to rebel against the Lord by refusing to go in and to take the land as God had commanded. They rightly identified that in acting the way that they were, that the people were rebelling against God, against the Lord. In verse 11, God himself speaks of the people's reaction as another example of the people despising him. In verse 22, God speaks of the people having seen my glory, and my signs that I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not obeyed my voice." So the people's spirit was a spirit of rebellion, a spirit of disobedience. They knew what God wanted them to do, but they didn't want to do it. They knew that Moses and Aaron were God's appointed leaders, but they wanted to choose a new leader to take them back to Egypt, a leader of their own. So in contrast to the people, Caleb's spirit of faith led naturally to a desire to obey God and to go in and to take possession of the land. When God said that he would give them the land and give the victory over the peoples who currently live there, Caleb believed him, and so he was willing to obey him and to go in and to take possession of the land. His faith was seen in his willingness to obey. The rest of the spies had heard the same promises, but they didn't believe them, and so they weren't going to obey. They were going to rebel. True faith always leads to obedience to God's commands. Our obedience this side of heaven will not be perfect. We will fail, but it should be purposeful. It should be our desire and our goal to obey God. For a person who claims to be a Christian, their life must be characterized by obedience to God's commands. If it's not, then their profession of faith has to be seriously questioned. And each of us needs to look at our lives and ask ourselves the question, is my life characterized by an obedience to God's commands? Because if it's not, we need to seriously look and question whether we really have faith or not at all. So, Caleb had a spirit. He had a spirit of faith, and he had a spirit of obedience. In the third place, he had a spirit of gratitude and not a spirit of ingratitude. It's easier perhaps to begin with the ingratitude of the 10 spies and the rest of the people, so that we can see Caleb's gratitude by contrast. As we read what they say, we are sometimes staggered by their ingratitude towards God after all that he has done for them. He's brought them out of Egypt, delivering them from slavery. A year or so before this event, they were labouring in the heat of the Egyptian sun for an uncaring tyrant who demanded that they make more and more bricks with less and less materials. You remember how Pharaoh kept on increasing their quota of bricks and demanding that they meet this, and then when they did meet it, then he denied them access to straw and told them to go and get their own straw, but still make the same number of bricks. And you remember how they had to throw their male boys into the River Nile. So God had delivered them from all that, and yet they weren't at all grateful. He brought them miraculously through the Red Sea, as we've said already, and he provided for them miraculously in the wilderness, manna every day and water and quail. He'd been with them and blessed them in so many ways, yet all they show is this incredible ingratitude. Caleb, on the other hand, had a different spirit. He was grateful for all of God's provision and all of God's deliverance in the past, and that no doubt made him all the more determined to go where God was going to lead. Unbelief has a short memory. People seem to forget all that God had done for them. Faith, however, remembers our past blessings, and our remembrance of them and our gratitude for them should help us to face the future with confidence, not because we know what the future holds, but because we know who holds the future. The people were characterized by grumbling and complaining. As Christians, we shouldn't be known as grumblers or complainers. There are things that we do need to complain about, but our general attitude to things should not be one of grumbling and complaining. We should be people who appreciate God's blessings and be thankful, rather than be grumblers and complainers. And sadly, in my work quite often I have come across people who have been grumblers or complainers, and then to my sadness I have found later on that they have been at least professing Christians, and that's not a good thing. Okay, in the fourth place then we come to see that Caleb had a spirit of wholeheartedness, not a spirit of half-heartedness. A spirit of wholeheartedness, not a spirit of half-heartedness. We admire people who are committed and who really put their hearts into whatever they're doing. And likewise, we're never impressed by people who do things as if they couldn't really care less about whether they did them or not. And the majority of the spies were at best half-hearted in their service. They were willing to serve God as long as it didn't cost too much, as long as it didn't take them out of their comfort zone. But Caleb was different. God's verdict was that he followed him fully or wholeheartedly. And this is the most often repeated description we have of Caleb in the Bible. Nearly every time we read about Caleb, it has got this little statement in it: he followed the Lord fully or wholeheartedly. And these are the kind of followers that God wants. Not those with great gifts who with minimal effort can put on a good show, but those who put their whole heart into serving him. On the contrary, those who are half-hearted are of no use to God. He wants our whole heart. You remember how Jesus summed up the Ten Commandments: love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbour as yourself. Remember how Jesus in the book of Revelation described the church in Laodicea. He says, I know your works, you're neither cold nor hot. Would that you were either cold or hot. So, because you're lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spit you out of my mouth. Caleb exemplified the wholehearted, fully committed servant of God. And as such, he is a challenging example to us. I wonder how God views our service, yours and mine. Are we just doing the minimum that we think we can get away with? Or are we putting our all into following and serving King Jesus? Part of being wholehearted for Caleb was being different from the majority. He had to take a different view. And for Christians, very often that is how part of our wholehearted service will be, by being different. We need to be willing to be the one who won't laugh at that joke which is unsuitable. We won't get involved. We may be the only one who's not happy to take part in that activity which isn't glorifying to God. So Christians need to be willing, as part of their wholehearted service, to be different from others and to take a stand when that is necessary. And the way our society is going, I'm sure that's going to become increasingly the case, that we will have to be different from those who take the majority view in society on many issues. So we have had four of the aspects of Caleb's spirit and how it was different. We're going to just a little break now before we do the final one, and we're going to read again from this time from the book of Joshua. If you want to turn to the book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 14, I'm going to read from verses 6 to 14. Okay, so that's on page 281, just starting at the bottom of page 281 of the Marine Bibles. This takes place after the children of Israel have gone in and have entered the promised land. And they haven't completely conquered it yet, but they're distributing the, parceling out the various parts of the land. Now the men of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite said to him, you know what the Lord said to Moses the man of God at Kadesh Barnea about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land, and I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt with fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day Moses swore to me, the land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance, and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years, since the time he said this to Moses, while Israel moved about in the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this whole country that the Lord promised to me that day. You yourself heard then that the Amalekites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out, just as he said. And Joshua blessed Caleb son of Jephunneh and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite ever since, because he followed the Lord the God of Israel wholeheartedly. Hebron used to be called Kiriath Arba after Arba, who was the greatest man among the Amalekites, and the land had rest from war. And then we just turn over to the two verses in the next chapter, chapter 15, verses 13 and 14. In accordance with the Lord's command to him, Joshua gave to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, a portion in Judah, Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. Arba was the forefather of Anak. From Hebron, Caleb drove out the Anakites, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, descendants of Anak. And we'll just stop there. Okay, the fifth aspect of Caleb's spirit, how he was different, was that he had a spirit of perseverance, not a spirit of resignation. In these verses we just read from Joshua, we encounter Caleb 45 years later, after 45 years after the chapters we read in the book of Numbers. And at this point the children of Israel have entered the land, but the land has not all been conquered or distributed yet. And we find here Caleb approaching Joshua and reminding him of the promise that God and Moses had made to him 45 years earlier, that promise of an inheritance in the land. And Caleb is now 85 years old by this stage, but he's just as keen as he was 45 years previously to get his hands on the promised inheritance. He has a spirit of perseverance. And what is the bit of land that he asked Joshua for? Was it a nice, flat, safe piece of real estate where he could build his retirement home? Not a bit of it. Rather, it was a hill country around Hebron where those very giants lived that the others had been so scared of. This was the challenge that at 85 years old, Caleb was champing at the bit to take on. He was still as strong in body and in faith as he had been 45 years before, when he had first seen those hills and cities and giants on that spy mission. In his own words, "I am this day 85 years old. I am still as strong today as I was in the days of in the day Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke to me on that day. For you heard in that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out, just as the Lord said." Caleb then had a spirit of perseverance. He didn't start well, but fade. He kept going right to the end. And we see him here at 85, still with that spirit of faith and determines to obey God. And we see from that very last verse we read that he actually did drive out those giants from Hebron and gained the inheritance that he'd been promised. It must have seemed long, those 40 years wandering in the wilderness for Caleb. He must have been thinking, if only the people had accepted the report that he and Joshua had brought, they would have been in the promised land, enjoying the blessings of it by this stage. He must have gone to a lot of funerals over those 40 years, because as you remember, God promised that those who were over 20 years old would die in the wilderness and wouldn't be allowed to enter. Somebody has calculated that on average 130 people must have died every day during their 40 years in the wilderness. So he must have seen a lot of funerals. But he kept going, and he kept going. He had a spirit of perseverance. Caleb's not mentioned in Hebrews 11, where we read of the great heroes of the faith. He's not mentioned by name, but I believe he is there, because in verse 33 of Hebrews 11 it says, it speaks of those who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises. And Caleb certainly did that. He conquered the kingdom that had been promised to him. He obtained the promised inheritance through persevering faith. So while one epitaph for Caleb could be the man with a different spirit, I think the best one for him would be, he followed the Lord fully, for that is the phrase that is repeated again and again any time we read about Caleb. Wouldn't you love to have that epitaph as yours? May God give us the grace to have the faith, to have the obedience, to have the gratitude, to have the wholehearted commitment and the perseverance that Caleb had. And then maybe to one day we might have that epitaph too, like he had, that we followed the Lord fully. Now Caleb is a wonderful example to us of what it means to be a faithful follower of the Lord. But of course he wasn't perfect. We're not told about any of his specific sins, but we know that none of the sons of Adam have ever lived a perfect life, and that only Jesus has ever lived on this earth in a perfect way. But Caleb points forward to Jesus, the one who would fully embody all of these characteristics of faith, obedience and perseverance. And in a way that Caleb could never do, Jesus followed his father's will fully and completely. His perfect obedience was necessary if he was to live the life that his people failed to do and that would be credited to their account. In his death, he defeated that greatest giant and enemy of the Lord's people, Satan himself, as he died in the place of sinners like you and me. He stormed the strongholds of Satan to set us free from the chains that held us in our sin. So if you aren't a Christian today, then looking at Caleb and admiring Caleb won't really help you. While there's much to admire in Caleb, Caleb can't save you. Jesus, however, the ultimate example of one who followed the Lord fully, the ultimate example of one who persevered to the end, right up to a death on the cross on behalf of sinners, he is the one who can save you. So if you've never looked to Jesus, then you need to do that today. Cry out to him for mercy, and you too can begin your journey to the promised land of heaven. Amen.